This is James McElhinney. Concept and Painting, an exhibition of the artist and critic Robert C. Morgan, is now on view at Proyectos Monclova in Mexico City. The show opened on March 23rd and runs through April 29th. I first met Robert when we both taught on Fridays at Pratt Institute in Brooklyn. We were in different departments, but at midday, we each went off campus for lunch. On one of those days, we found ourselves at a restaurant waiting for dining companions who never arrived. Rather than dining alone, we began a series of conversations of which this is the latest. Last Friday, April 7th, I sat down with Robert at his home near Union Square to learn more about the exhibition. Hello, Robert. It's nice to see you again.
Nice to see you, James.
So I'm very excited to hear about your current exhibition that's on view in Mexico City. You just attended the opening and other events related to it last week, I believe.
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago. And I was wondering if you could share with us how you came to connect with this gallery.
Well, there are different ways that that process happens, and I would consider what happened with me to be somewhat unusual, because I went to an exhibition to see the work of a friend of mine at the Drawing Center in Lower Manhattan on Worcester Street, former Soho. Well, I guess it's still Soho, but it's not the art district that it used to be, which has been usurped by West Chelsea. But anyway, it was a wonderful show. The artist's name was Gabriel de la Mora, who happens to be Mexican, and he introduced me to the gallerists who run the gallery that he's involved with, which is called Proyectos Monclova, and they are in Mexico City. Anyway, I said hello to this gentleman, and he said, "Oh, Mr. Morgan, we were just looking at your work." And I said, "Oh, that's great. What essay did you read?" And he said, "No, I'm talking about your artwork." And I said, "That's impossible. No one looks at my artwork. They only read my essays." And he said, no, we're looking at it and have been looking at it seriously, and we're very happy to meet you." And I said, "Well, I'm very flattered." And then he said, "How about tomorrow?" And I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Can we come over?" And I said, of course, what time?" They came over, and we spent about an hour and a half. Everything seemed to click. And then he said, "Listen, we'd like to come back in a couple of weeks, fly back from Mexico City, and speak with you a little more seriously for, 3 or 4 days. And I said, great. So they came back, and we went to my studio upstate, and for 3 solid days, from morning till night, we looked at work, uncreated work, looked at it again, talked continuously about what I was doing as an artist. And the end of the third night, they say, "Listen, I hope we're not being too forward on this, but we would like very much for you to be part of our gallery, and we'd like to give you an important show." And I said, "Sounds good to me. Let's go for it."
How long ago was that?
That was about, August of 2016.
So very recently.
Less than a year.
Wow. Yeah. So they really were serious and moved very quickly. Had they seen your shows at Rooster?
No.
Here in New York?
They hadn't. They only knew it from the internet. You know, it's interesting that I've always distrusted the internet for some reason in terms of a way of seeing art. But they had a little help from Gabriel, I think, because he had known me about 15 years earlier, 16 years, whenever it was. When he was my student at Pratt Institute, I had introduced him to conceptual art, and he was very grateful for that introduction, because it had an impact on his career, and still does. Gabriel's a magnificent artist, and I've always believed in what he did, and so this seemed to transpire in relation to that somehow. I can always tell when people really love the work or whether they don't. And these people absolutely love my work. And I was very gratified by that, very flattered by that. And they understood it. A couple months later, whenever it was, they sent up shippers who packed up over 60 paintings and other works, photographic works, and some drawings that I had, older drawings. And it was sent down to Mexico City. After the art fair there in Mexico City in, when was it, late February, early March, they started looking at the work and reframing it in some cases, cleaning it up, because some of it goes back to the late 60s, early 70s. They put it together, then they began the process of the catalog and the installation. And I was so impressed by the level of organization, the insight they had in terms of how to show the work, because I wasn't there when they were mounting it. Many of the decisions they made were, for me, absolutely the right decisions. And when I came down a couple days before the opening, there were only maybe three minor changes in terms of hanging that I made. Given the fact that there are over 70 works in the show, that's not so bad, you know, that they really had figured it out. And this was, to me, a kind of verification that my hunch was correct, that they understood what they were dealing with in terms of my work. And I have to say, James, that I've always had this parallel career between my work as a writer and critic and my work as an artist. And in the United States, I felt that at a certain point, that if I was doing both, or if I was speaking about both, that it would be a liability, that people wouldn't believe it. Okay.
So you're saying there was a pressure on you from the marketplaces, however you define them, whether it be publishing or the galleries, that you should do one or the other, but not both.
Yeah, and I got tired of having to explain it. And this was becoming increasingly true as people were becoming more and more aware of my writings, my books. It was too difficult to introduce the fact that I happen to be a working artist. And so I took a hiatus from working for the 90s, basically, and came back to it literally in 2000, slowly came back. It wasn't as easy as it sounds. I needed the break because I was losing my way in terms of what I really wanted to be doing as an artist.
So you're talking about making artwork.
That's right. That's
you basically took a sabbatical from the studio.
That's right. You know, it was during that time that I published most of my books. Okay. And, I mean, you know, 6 or 7 books were published during that period. It was a very important time for that. And, of course, it raised consciousness in terms of my work as a critic and art historian. That part was okay. I was still in academia at that time, and I was liking academia less and less, even though I was becoming a better teacher, which is kind of ironic and interesting, from at least my point of view.
Were you still teaching it at RIT then?
Yeah, I was.
At Rochester Institute of Technology.
But once I started getting back into my work, I decided I wanted to see if I could get an early retirement, and they were nice enough to give me that. So by 2002, I left Rochester and with the honorary degree of Professor Emeritus. And as I was saying a moment ago, it was a tough process at the beginning. I was a Fulbright senior scholar over in Korea, and during that time is when I was able to really think more clearly. I had to get out of New York to think more clearly about, you know, where I was going to go with my work. And slowly it began to evolve. Things began to click around 2008, 2009. And then I was really where I wanted to be. But it took me about 5 years to really get my gravitational relationship to my intention, okay? Because it's not just, you know, going back to where you left off. I couldn't do that. But I had to take what I had done from that period and put it within a more recent context. I'm not talking about a trend. I'm talking about in terms of my own thinking,
mm-hmm.
because I had really advanced my thinking in terms of how to do art. I had to decide, am I going to stop writing entirely or am I going to try and do both? Well, I considered many options, and I finally figured out a way of doing both where one would not interfere with the other. It's too complicated and too hermetic to try and explain that, but I figured it out. And once I got that confidence in myself to function on that level, regardless of what people thought about it, you know, I just went ahead with it. And so this event that I just told you about, which was an important event, and the show is still on, and as far as I know, it's doing quite well. I'm going to be part of that gallery, and other things are happening in the near future that I think are going to be very useful and helpful in terms of how I progress with my work. But I'm loving what I'm doing right now, I have to say.
So where did you find the common root or agreeable starting points for both the writing and the studio work that remove them from conflict?
I think I told you the story in one of our previous tapes about meeting the artist Robert Motherwell.
Right.
And one of the reasons I wanted to meet Motherwell, and not only did I love his paintings, although I knew that I was not going to paint in that way. And, you know, it's hard to explain that. But the point is that I was much more interested in geometry. And, I mean, Motherwell, I think, had a very clear structural idea in terms of his elegies and in terms of his window paintings, and particularly what he called the open series, which I happen to like very much. What interested me also was that he was a writer, he was a scholar, he was an editor, and I liked that stuff. I didn't like to be in an academic setting doing it, but, you know, I liked the fact that I could write, that I could express my ideas in writing, that I could be a scholar artist, a kind of Western literati, that kind of thing. I never lost that. That desire, and which is, you know, something that is very close to me and very much a part of my practice. I never wanted to be one of these people that was writing, trying to promote hard edge painting or abstract painting or whatever. That was not my direction. If anything, I would go to very opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of people doing art that maybe I would have never thought of doing, or working with a medium that I, you know, had never really thought of doing, but that it interested me. And so rather than being an advocate for people maybe doing art that was similar to mine, I was interested in writing about art that was, in fact, work that I loved but was quite different from what I did. And the more I got into that practice, the more clear it became in terms of what I was doing. So in other words, by allowing the extension of my interest as a writer to move as far as I wanted to go with it, it really helped me focus very purposefully and directly and incisively on my art. Okay. I've always believed in the idea in art, not at the expense of the material, which is one of the points that I very much agree with in terms of Chinese art and I think East Asian art in general, that the idea is not something you separate from the work, but it's very much embedded in it. And I suppose it depends on what kind of work we're talking about, and I'm thinking primarily of ink painting. I wasn't an ink painter, although, you know, when I was at the beginning of my career, I worked a great deal with ink and graphite together, and those drawings, in fact, are in the exhibition currently. There are 38 of them that are hanging in Mexico City, and people seem to love that work, and it's, you know, very open, very exploratory, you know, dealing with reasonably primary shapes and that kind of thing, but it has a gestural quality to it, given the nature of the brush and so forth. And that happened as a result of having taken brush painting from a Japanese artist and calligrapher in 1966 and 1967. So that by the fall of 1967, I was ready to do something that was, you know, artistically involved with ink. And that's when I made those drawings. And now they have a special enclave in the exhibition floor with those 38 drawings. And I'm very happy that they're there, and I'm hoping that they will get into a very good collection.
As you were speaking, it was occurring to me that you've always been concerned with writing and painting.
Right.
And ink painting and calligraphy are virtually and inextricably intertwined.
Well, they can be. And in fact, the great painters, they were also, in many cases, calligraphers, but of course they emphasized the painting. I think that that's to the great advantage of Asian artists. And this is one reason why the idea cannot be separated from the work. And I'm convinced that this is true in relation to traditional Asian painting. Now, whereas in the West, we need to create a category called conceptual art and separate it from abstract expressionism or something else. But the point is that there, you don't have to make that separation. And so I wanted to be the writer, and I wanted to be the hard-edge classicist that I am, okay? And this is what I feel that I am contributing, this notion of the very, emotionally geometric statement, because I feel that there is a bias in this country toward the gesture as being expressive, but not geometry, having the power or the impetus to create an emotional response. So there are a couple things that I disagree with among some of my colleagues in painting who are dealing with similar approaches in terms of geometry. I dislike large scale. I think that the scale should be more, shall we say, intimate, mm-hmm. in terms of being able to really understand what you're looking at and see the complexity of what you're looking at, even though the work may not be so complex in terms of the amount of material. Often I will paint over crowded areas of a painting just to renew the space, to bring the space mm-hmm. back. Because I feel that what I'm doing is creating space, and this is something different than assuming the space to exist.
Well, a lot of your paintings employ what I would call alternate primaries. There are several colors that repeat themselves again and again, certain kinds of browns and certain kinds of earth tones, and of course, always the color black.
Well, actually, a couple of things. That's not entirely correct. The black, yes, at the beginning, I was using black. But the more I got involved with Asian painting, and also I did some work on Ad Reinhardt for one of the galleries in New York for one of their shows, and I realized that it wasn't black, that it was a mixture mm-hmm. of various tones of either raw or burnt umber and ultramarine blue. And that would create a warmer black. So for a number of years now, I've been mixing black rather than taking it out of the tube, so to speak. And I've never actually used primaries. I use metallic colors. Mm-hmm. Beginning back as early as 1970, I was using silver in a series called Acoustical Variations. I came back to that on several occasions. But then in recent years, I've been expanding those metallic paints to include copper, bronze, and occasionally gold. Not very often the gold, but occasionally. And I've often thought about that, and it occurred to me that my fine arts degree, my Master of Fine Arts, because I don't have an undergraduate degree in art, I was casting aluminum and bronze. Not because I thought that was necessarily the direction of my work, but just because I wanted to know how to do it, okay? I thought, well, now I'm using iridescent silver and I'm using iridescent bronze. Therefore, I'm giving sculpture to the surface. And somehow I found great satisfaction in that, and also the fact that the light would reflect off these colors and the colors themselves would be placed on this warm black so that there would be this absorption and reflection of light at the same instant. And I was convinced, having over many years study the Tao Te Ching, I was very interested in this simultaneity rather than opposition, that within the instant you could feel the absorption and reflection of light.
The wonderful catalog that was produced by Proyectos Monclova, yeah. And they are in Colonia Roma Norte.
That's right.
In Mexico City.
That's correct.
Wonderful catalog with an introduction by Kim Cordova.
Yes.
And with an essay by Carter Ratcliffe.
That's correct.
And one of the images in the catalog is an early painting that you did called Tao Te Ching.
That's right.
Which is essentially a bisected circle, mm-hmm. as I remember, yellow, mm-hmm. and otherwise a very austere abstract composition. Mm. Can you speak a little bit about what drew you to Taoism and what continues to keep you engaged?
Well, I had the great advantage of, even though I was from the northeast, my father was from Boston, my mother was from New York. But growing up in Southern California, it was closer to Asia. And I remember in college becoming acquainted with a writer named Alan Watts. And through Alan Watts, I learned about Daisetsu Suzuki, who was a Japanese scholar of Zen Buddhism and also occasionally wrote about Tao. There is a connection, by the way. I've always felt that the evolution of Zen, or Chan in Chinese, was the betrothal of Taoism with Buddhism in a certain way. That you took certain aspects of meditation, coming from dhyana, which is a Sanskrit word meaning meditation, into Buddhism. And then you had a certain kind of, shall we say, spontaneity, tsucha, where the mind begins to operate with a kind of intuitive force, shall we say. Perhaps in a certain sense there is a preparation in terms of how you choose to live your life and how you choose to interpret what you see and how you sense the reality around you. I was very taken by this aspect of the Tao Te Ching. The Tao, of course, means the way. I was kind of looking for the way when I was younger, when I was 23, 24. And those drawings that I mentioned, which are called Living Smoke and Clear Water drawings, done with the calligraphy brush, the ink, and the graphite, these drawings are very much a kind of verification, self-verification, I suppose, self-verification of emptiness or non-self. I like this phrase that Suzuki talks about called sunyata, which means literally the English translation for him was the pregnancy of the void, the idea that something is coming out of emptiness. And that idea, which is embedded very strongly in both Tao and Chan, has been a guiding force for me over the years.
A very strong, iconic, canonical image of speaking about, as you were before, primary shapes.
Yes.
The idea of the circle drawn with the brush expressing
on the cover of the catalog, void. I'm drawing circles in the sand. But these are not just indeterminate circles. These rely on using a linear measurement for an ellipse.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's hard to explain. But anyway, I derive the ellipses from the pendulum going in two coordinates, X and Y. And then the diameter of the circle is where I start. I think there were 9 steps, if I'm not mistaken. I would walk 9 on the arcs until I got into the center and then began the other coordinate outward. And every time I stopped after 9 steps, I would bend down and draw a circle around myself. So there's literally, there's a drawing there of, you know, what a preparation drawing, so to speak, before I actually did the performance. And that preparation drawing gives you the constellation of, you know, the points where I would bend down and draw the circle around mm-hmm. myself. And the question mm-hmm. has come up about the circle, as it has this afternoon. And I've always felt comfort with the circle. I was born July 10th, so I think the moon has something to do with this. I think the planet has something to do with this. In fact, you know, how I conceive of reality, I'm very comfortable with the idea of cyclical time, for example, as in the seasons. This is something that I feel, I intuitively understand. I would go so far as to say that the emptiness of mind, which is sometimes referred to as ma, M-A, but, you know, there's also a kind of sequence. There's wu wei, which is the stillness without motion. There is the shi wei, which is the namelessness, okay, which is very important. Anyway, the point is that you really can't identify what this emptiness is other than, from my point of view, you feel it in relation to nature. That emptiness and nature, I think, are very close. Now, what I mean by that is, what is the mind in nature? Does nature have a mind? I don't think there's any way we can know that. There's no way we can prove that. And who would want to? But the point is that when we were in a still relationship with nature, observing nature, being part of nature, we understand that we don't need to superimpose, we don't need to coerce anything, that we can be in that state. Now, I don't want to be pretentious and suggest that this is what my work is accomplishing. I'm just talking about the way I'm thinking in relation to working, which is something else. I mean, how you read it or how anyone else reads it is up to them. I'm not going to insist that they have to see it the way I do. Frankly, I'd rather that they didn't see it the way that I do.
Well, otherwise, one might wonder that an artist who has a clearly formed thought that they want to demonstrate is engaged in a form of illustration.
There you go.
And as such, subordinating the artistic process to some more banal aim.
Well, this is one of the big problems, as I was explaining to my graduate students this morning, is that nowadays, it seems, in art academia, that everyone has to produce a text. And the unfortunate aspect of producing a text before you actually do the work or before you finish the work or whatever is that you're trying to prove something in relation to your intentions, which is absolutely wrong from my point of view in terms of why art exists. If anything, I would say, if we can use that bifurcation of Immanuel Kant, that what you pull out of the art experientially upon sensing it, seeing it, feeling it, tasting it, hearing it, whatever it is, that what you pull out is an a posteriori position. Okay, mm-hmm. You know, it's based on the experience. To load it all at the beginning with an a priori kind of predetermination is incorrect.
It's to impoverish the potential.
I think so very much. And one reason why this is, I think, an important point. I have great admiration and respect for the artist Saul LeWitt. However, I dislike the notion that you have a linguistic structure that somehow presupposes what the work is going to be. And it took me a long time, I think, to come to terms with that and to finally reject that idea, because I can tell you, I do drawings in my journals and so forth, and almost never does the painting end up being the drawing. It just, the drawings kind of, when I'm stuck on something, the drawings help me figure out possibilities for how this thing can go.
So the drawings are a thought process that might precede or might accompany a different process that engages materials that in time become a painting.
I know what my materials are. It's right. I need the latitude to be able to move in the way that I want to move without feeling that I have to somehow accommodate a predetermined idea of the form. Now, I'm very given to this phrase from Wittgenstein's Tractatus, published in 1921. And the end of the second section, he says in one of the propositions, form is the possibility of structure. Okay, and I've probably cited this phrase too many times, but it's so accurate in terms of the way I think, because I don't think structure and form are the same. And people, you know, certainly from an American formalist point of view, they seem to put these two together, but they're not. I mean, you know, can say on some level they're together, but the structure is really the vocabulary that you begin with, okay? In other words, you have certain parameters that you're working with, and you have to know what those are. You have to lay them out on the table, so to speak. But where it goes in terms of form is something where you need the latitude to make that happen. And therefore, I can't put the structure and form together at the beginning. I have to take the vocabulary that is within the structure, the parameters that are within the structure, and model that in relation to form. Now, it's not a resolution so much that I'm talking about, although I think I used that word earlier, but it's not what I mean, okay? It's not so much a revolution, because the resolution, maybe it's a revolution, but not a resolution. But the point is that often I will have a painting. I'm stuck with it. I put it up on the wall. I'm doing this more and more. And I wait until something happens where I get a hunch, I get a sense that this has to happen in order for this painting to work. Okay? So I take it down and I begin to work on it. And sometimes I'm lucky and it just happens the right way. Sometimes I'm just not getting it, and either the painting is going to be destroyed or it's going to go back on the wall, and it might go back on the wall for a month, a year, 2 years, who knows. But the point is that there's something. I've got a painting right now that I'm thinking about. It's clearly in my mind, and the painting right now is absolutely not a painting. I mean, in the sense of its completeness, okay? And I think I actually put this in an exhibition, and when I saw it on the wall, I kept coming back to this, and I thought, oh God, how could I possibly show this painting? Well, anyway, now it's no longer going to be shown until something changes, and it may be radical. You know, I'm not interested in beauty as a painter. I'm interested in some other form of attraction. On the other hand, I'm not interested in going against beauty. I'm not, you know, reacting to beauty. That's not my point. It's just I think the beauty is beyond my control, okay? I mean, it's sort of like, trying to predetermine how people are going to respond to your work. And, you know, I can't say, oh, isn't it beautiful? Because, you know, maybe it's not beautiful to them. And so that's really not a quality that I can deal with. Because, I can't get a fix on what that means, and I'm not so interested in what that means. But what I do need to find is a kind of, for a better word, energy. And if I find the energy, then I'm dancing, okay? I'm dancing. And there's no formula for that.
You just recognize it when you see it.
That's right.
Well, the problem with beauty is that in today's global community, there are so many different ideas about what that constitutes.
Yes.
And many, many cultures have ideals that would clash sharply with a traditional Western or even East Asian concept of beauty. At the same time, there are a lot of cultures around the globe that make no distinction between the fine arts and the decorative arts. Mm. It's hard, especially, I mean, you're a person who is engaged in the arts in many different parts of the world. Mm-hmm. It would seem to me that you'd be very chary of trying to present ideas about beauty or hierarchies of art that would in any way seem too European, because that would, again, smack of you know, ethnocentrism or Eurocentrism or a kind of colonial attitude towards, you know, like ethnographic art. You wrote a wonderful essay about a Nigerian artist, Inka Shonabari, yeah. In Chelsea, and his work, you know, would be challenging to some, but I think more importantly, I mean, we weren't even considering artists from West Africa 20, 30 years ago.
That's true.
People like Elon Atsui. Mm. How do you see the role you would like to play in art as an international artist?
Yeah, well, we've touched on this before, James, and I always appreciate the question, I have to say, because it's always challenging for me, because I suppose I don't have a pat answer. But my sensibility is, I think, relatively generous in the sense that I want to know what's going on in the world, and there's no better way for me to understand that than through art, okay? And therefore, if I'm in Iran or if I'm in Indonesia, if I'm in China, if I'm in Argentina, if I'm in Mexico or the United States, I mean, these are all different cultures. They have their own languages. They have their own lifestyles. They have their own art. Now, I really believe that there is a connection between art and culture, and I don't believe in dissecting art away from culture, like what's happening now in places in the Middle East, where the Guggenheim has just been completed.
Abu Dhabi,
for example.
The Emirates,
yeah. I think that just to take works of art and put them in the middle of this desert, I mean, if there's some kind of contextual relationship that is significant on some level, then I can understand it. But just having them as objects on the wall because of, you know, the fact they represent a certain amount of money or whatever it is, you know, I'm against that point of view.
Well, that is very much connected to regional politics and also economics and the fact that you have these independent, very, very small micro countries, very, very rich, stuck between two hostile powers in the Persian Gulf region.
Well,
other subtext.
I don't think that there's a real contribution in terms of using art from the point of view of objecthood to erase the context, the cultural context. Mm-hmm. And just to show it off as an object. I mean, how many years were collectors going to Africa and taking carvings and bringing them back? And until Bill Rubin did that show in 1983 at the Museum of Modern Art, where he was, challenged in terms of the use of these objects taken out of the context of their performative relationship or their tribal relationship.
Right, the ritual function.
The ritual function. That these objects only had meaning within the ritual function, and not isolated as objects. So, getting back to your question about, you know, how do I see myself in relation to this world global phenomenon relating to, you know, what is now considered a global art world or a global market. And I have to say that I remain critical to that. I feel that what I do needs a critical edge in order for me to do art, okay? That I can't imagine not having a critical edge in doing art. But when I'm doing art, I'm totally connected to my own thought process in terms of what I'm doing. Okay. I'm not trying to be part of a trend. I'm not trying to compete with anybody. I'm simply doing my own art. And it's hard to explain this in a rational way, perhaps, but by maintaining a critical edge in terms of what I feel is damaging to art, okay, in terms of the wonderful force that it can be, in terms of unifying people and perhaps creating a better world. Why not? You know, I mean, I'm interested in that for sure. And I've stated that on numerous occasions, and I suppose the most significant is my book, The End of the Art World, which is now 18 years old. It should be reprinted, by the way. The point is that on that level, the level that I'm speaking, the necessity of a critical position in relation to my own solitariness as an artist, which I love that notion of being solitary. I mean, there's no conflict for me between the two. They are complementary to one another.
Before we were speaking, and you liked the idea of being compared to like a Chinese literati.
Yes.
In your hermitage up in Columbia County.
And sure.
Having access to everything you need, just enough of everything you need, in order to sustain your practice as a thinker, a writer, and as
right.
an artist.
Right. Well, I feel that, yes, I mean, there I have the physical situation, mm-hmm. The habitat, as it were, and the working environment, and nature, of course. So there's, you know, I suppose in a traditional sense, there's something ideal about it, although my refrigerator went out a week ago, and so, you know, having to replace the refrigerator is hardly ideal, but that's part of how we live today.
Well, it's not the popular image of an artist with this big, giant loft and
right.
and paintings everywhere, all this inventory all over the place. It really is a kind of hermetic refuge. And
in a way.
There's a certain alchemy to what you do,
yeah.
I think.
Yes, I like that term.
Too, speaking about abstract painting, one must remember that Malevich's revolutionary painting was fairly small.
Mm-hmm.
And one can also think about people like Paul Klee
mm-hmm.
and insisting on this intimate scale and this kind of...
It's funny that I've been compared to both, although...
I'm not surprised.
Although they never come into my... Well, I shouldn't say they never come into my thinking. They do more art historically than my thinking in terms of... working as an artist, which, you know, listen, whatever people come up with, if I think it's sincere, if I think it's an honest response, I don't care. You know, if I think it's pretentious, then, you know, I just ignore
it. It is true, though, that when one thinks about hard-edged geometric abstraction, one might see a thumbnail of your work online or a reproduction in a book, and they might be absolutely shocked to find out that it's a very modest scale, like 12 inches square.
Right, right. This is true. Well, scale and size are not exactly the same.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah, and I'm very curious about why the expectation of abstract painting in 2017 has to be large, okay?
It's a convention.
It's a convention,
yeah.
And there's no reason why it should be. And also, I'm, as I mentioned, against this bias that only the sweeping gesture can have emotional viability. I think that geometry can also have emotional viability, and I don't think it has to happen on a large scale.
Well, a large painting is obviously broadcasting something to multiple people.
Right.
Like if it's the size of a billboard, or if it's hanging in the wall of some midtown lobby,
you know, I think,
it's public art.
Yeah, I mean, if you're increasing the scale significantly, you know, ultimately you're going to be in a decorative position. You know?
Exactly.
And, you know, I have seen so many... artists kind of swept into that, whether they are aware of it or not, you know, who are dealing abstractly.
Is that commercial pressure, do you think? Because people have
I think it's very difficult to escape commercial pressure today.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my gallery, I have to say, Proyectus Monclova, Teo and Paulina are two wonderful gallerists. The director of the gallery, Kim Cordova, is, you know, magnificent in terms of her work. They're all magnificent. And they respect what I'm trying to do. I think they get it right when they talk about it. I think they have good collectors, and they think about the collectors, you know, before they sell the work, and they make sure that, you know, the works are going to be taken seriously in the right way. And this is something very new for me at this, you know, age of...
You're a re-emerging artist.
That's right, yeah, in a sense.
How does it feel to be a new millennial at an advanced, relatively advanced age? The work does look like the work of a young person.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Getting back to your first question, I'm still trying to figure out how it feels, but... I think I'm delighted.
Well, you seem pleased.
Thank you.
And you should be, I'm sure. Just one other thing. I mean, just to continue the discussion about the size of your work, if you'll allow, to me it seems like you're speaking to one person at a time rather than to an audience.
Yeah. Well, that's where Duchamp left off. And that's where I want to begin.
Thanks so much for
My
this
pleasure.
Conversation.
Okay.
Concept and Painting, an exhibition by Robert Morgan at Proyectos Monclova in Mexico City, runs through April 29th. You can visit the gallery website at www.proyectosmonclova.com. This is James McElhenney. Thanks for listening.